Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Temple of the Muses, I am greatly honored to bring you Nick Curto Presents The Creative Process. Greetings and welcome, Nick.
Oh, thank you very much, Hercules. You know, I was just telling my guest this evening that I'm so appreciative and happy that I can do my podcast programs every Saturday night from my home here in Manhattan Island, and I don't have to travel to a studio to do the programs, because I've had the experience on other parts of my life of having to go to studios in various places, and it's such a convenience to do my program from my home. So it's just one of those wonderful little things that happen in my life, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad as well. It allows us to do a lot of things that I remember when I had my TV show, I had to travel to Manhattan to 23rd Street. I had to be there early to test all the equipment and to make sure everybody was there and to make sure the graphic that they were going to project was correct. And afterwards, reviewing the show, recording it in different format, it took like a good chunk of the day. Now, just sitting from home in Zoom, we could even do televised work as well.
We love that. We love that very much. Even when we do our new editions, which are Zoom meetings, Zoom shows, and they can see us as well as hear us, it still is in our homes. And I really love that. I really do. The technology has been so amazing in the last few years. I think up until 2 or 3 years ago, I never even knew what a Zoom meeting was. And now my life has many of them every week.
And in a very short period of time, we're going to have 3D recordings where
you can go.
I've seen the prototypes. Yes, we could have everybody in a room together and we can look like ourselves sitting around a table and talking, or we can look like cartoon characters or animals or anything we want to. So that's going to come before we know it. So I'm looking forward to our journey taking us there as well. And I'm looking forward to today's show. That is such an interesting topic. And your guests sound lovely.
Well, I'm very excited also. I think it will be a very unusual and very interesting episode of The Creative Process. So okay, we'll get started right now. Again, this is my podcast program is Nick Curto Presents The Creative Process, and I'm Nick Curto, your host. My featured guest for this live podcast program tonight is Roger Hill, who I met recently at an art show here in New York City that he and his wife, Joanne, traveled to see. The art show was to present the recent work of Roger's sister-in-law, Carol Cannon, who is a very, very gifted artist indeed, as well as a dear friend of mine. And that's how I originally met Roger and his wife, Joanne. And Roger, a very, very warm welcome to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Nick. Thank you for having me on your cast this evening. I hope I can entertain you.
Oh, I think the subject matter is unusual and terrific and a very interesting avenue of the creative process. Now, let me ask you first, where do you and your wife, Joanne, make your home?
We live in eastern Massachusetts, right on the coast, about 20 miles south of Boston.
Oh, that's a nice area. I'm familiar with that. I went to school at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design, right in Boston, Mass. In fact, right next to the Elizabeth Gardner Museum, Elizabeth Stewart Gardner Museum, right there on Huntington Avenue. So, and I of course, I made friends when I was in there for 4 years, and I did see that area. Quite a nice area to be in. I love Boston too. Boston was an incredible city. Go ahead.
I was your neighbor. I went to Wentworth.
Oh, really? Okay. Fantastic. I didn't know that. And it was a wonderful part of my life. I met so many incredibly talented new friends. Now they're dear friends of mine. We still stay in touch after all these years. And it was a great part of my life, and it launched me on my a creative career as a designer and also a graphic designer and advertising major. So that was a very good time in my life, and I really appreciated that very much. Now, I got to say that in your life so far, you have worn many hats of different occupations as well as hobbies. Now, my first question, and please take your time on this, but would you share with us, listeners tonight, a brief history of your life's journey that has taken you both in your occupations and also in your hobby interests? If you could do that for a bit, I would really appreciate that.
I'll be brief, but as I said, I went to college at Wentworth Institute, which was a very good institution in Boston, and I studied construction management. So I got into the construction field. I got interested in various sides of the business, and finally settled in Finnish carpentry, building cabinets and other furniture useful to the home.
Wonderful.
So I got to know wood pretty well. So later on, when other opportunities arose, I started running a very small sawmill where I had access to all kinds of wonderful wood, where I still occasionally do that today. But as I said, along the way, I've gotten some pretty nice pieces of wood, which I also turn wood on a lathe.
Oh.
And create bowls and other sort of artwork, as well as furniture and cabinets and things like that.
Fantastic. I briefly in school did do some woodworking projects, and it also involved spinning the wood and carving into that, and it was a lot of fun. And so I can understand why you would like that so much. Good for you. Now tell me more.
I've done that for quite a while, so now it's more of a hobby than anything else. But I still enjoy wood quite a bit, and still have a lot of it around the house to do various projects, and sometimes when I get some free time, I can build something for myself along the way.
You know, I got to say that I always feel when I either see something made of wood or actually create something, which I have done a little bit of that, but wood has almost a soul. It has a personality. It's alive. It's a beautiful, beautiful medium to work in. And I totally get why you would like that so much. And there's so many different kinds of wood and textures, and what you can do various stains. I'm sure you know quite a bit about that. And you said you did also bowls and things like that. Have you sold things like that, bowls and so forth?
I have in the past, but I mostly keep them. I like having them, and they're great to look at.
I agree with that. There's just something very unique about anything to do with wood and products of wood. I still have a wonderful salad bowl set with a big bowl and then all the smaller bowls all made of wood. And there's something about putting a salad in those bowls that makes a lot of sense. It's very aesthetic. I love doing that. And I have regular salad bowls that are ceramic, but if I always choose the wooden ones. You know, I just do.
Yeah.
So I really do understand that. Good for you to have that. Now, tell me more about other occupations and interests.
Well, and then as time went on,
before we get to the bees, I just want to know a real background, because I think that one thing leads to another, and I'm always really interested in that.
Well, that was going to be my segue into, and then as time went on, and I got some more free time. I started to learn of a beehive that was invented in Australia, which turned out not to, to work quite as well as it should, but I was fascinated by the carpenter and how he put the wood together and just a different concept. So the woodworking led me to do some research on this beehive, which eventually got me into keeping bees.
Now, that is a very unique area for sure. Did anybody in your life before, your grandfather or grandmother, any relatives or friends, have they ever been in that area of beekeeping or anything related to that?
No, they weren't. I don't know what it was that fascinated me about them, but they're just such an interesting insect, and it's just endless learning and endless different facts you learn about the life of a bee. And
I really want to get into that, because I also have always, even as a child, have been very fascinated with bees. And boy, they are as busy as bees. That that expression is true. They always look like they're on a mission, like they're working,
they've got
a schedule.
They work as a team, and they are certainly very, very, very good at what they do.
Boy, that is an understatement for sure. Absolutely. There's so much to talk about on the subject. Well, first of all, if it wasn't for our little friends, the bees, what would we be doing for food, do you think? No?
We probably wouldn't. According to the people in the know, about 65% of what you eat has something to do with a bee, whether it be...
That's phenomenal. Wow. I mean, that is incredible.
Avocados,
I know that's true.
Avocados, almonds, the oranges, apples, most things that grow in your garden are probably pollinated by a bee.
And you're naming everything that I love, and I think that most people also love. And I don't think people appreciate, for the most part, how vital the bee community is worldwide. They just, unfortunately, we take a lot of things for granted. You know, I've been guilty of that. I think everybody is guilty of that at some point. But you really can't do that. You really should be fair and really see what's happening and appreciate what's going on. And the bees and their amazing abilities. And I tell you, I'm blown away when I see what they do and how they do it, from a distance, but it is still totally amazing. And I love honeys. I love different kinds of. By the way, tell us if you will, because you'd be the one to ask, what different kinds of honeys are there?
There are a number of different variations on honey, and it depends on the season of the year. In the very beginning of the year, when you go outside and you look at the grass and you see the little tiny white flowers all over your grass, that's clover. That's the white clover. And so in the very beginning of the year, the very first honey or nectar rather that comes into the hive will most likely be clover honey. And if you do an early harvest, you can taste the difference. And if you waited till the middle of the summer and you have all the different trees and flowers that have now already come out. Another wonderful honey is dandelion honey, which obviously is the first crop of the year, let's say.
Interesting. What other kinds of honey? Oh, by the way, clover honey happens to be my favorite, at least so far, and I have clover honey in my kitchen right now, which I use on a variety of things. And I know a performer here in New York, and her name is Clover Honey. That's her professional stage name, which I always get a kick out of that she chose that name to represent her. But she's a wonderful actress and a performer. But Clover Honey is certainly one of my favorites. Now you said dandelions also, and what other kinds of honey are there?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the kind. It's the flora that you would have in the area where you are from.
And, oh, okay.
So within 50 or 60 miles, you can call that local honey. So what I have in my area might not, I mean, you're close. The native plants would be the same, but as you travel away from your area, the plants and flowers, things may differ. So honey from Florida would probably taste much different than honey from Massachusetts.
Interesting. Now, are bees worldwide? I mean, I don't think they'd be, of course, in the Antarctic and places like that, but generally speaking, are bees in most major areas of the world?
Sure. I'm a member of an apiary here in our neck of the woods, let's say, that we try to get our bees to climatize for the area that they're in. One of the problems beekeepers run into is to get started, you actually buy a box of bees. It's about the size of a shoebox, and it has approximately 10,000 bees in it, 3 pounds.
Wow.
Of bees. And so you have your hive all set up in your backyard and all the frames in it and food for them when they get there. And so you pour all the bees in. Well, the bees actually came from Georgia, where the summers and spring and fall are a little bit longer, and they're much milder than what we have up here. So the bees mm-hmm. can populate the hive for a much longer period of time. And come April, you go to one of these apiaries in Georgia and you buy a box of bees through a local bee club. So the bee club will place an order for 1,000 packages of bees. And
wow.
one of them is yours. It gets on a truck, comes to Massachusetts, where you install them into your beehive. Well, unfortunately, all of those bees are completely climatized to the Georgia climate.
Okay.
So if you bring them up here, it would be like dropping you and me in Alaska or
mm-hmm.
northern Canada and expect us to make it.
Wow.
And be able to survive. We are completely unclimatized, and we don't know to you and me where the grocery store would be, to the bees where all the flowers and plants would be. So with that said, our apiary supports are called overwintered bees. So you have a package of bees, and they do survive the winter. You know that they are somewhat climatized up here.
God bless them. Oh, my God. The little guys.
Very,
the little guys are
well,
amazing.
Those are the very hardy, strong bees. The the hardest thing for a beekeeper to do is to get your bees to live through the winter.
I can see that, yeah.
They used to be able to do it on their own just fine. And then man intervened, and it disrupted their wheel, let's say.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good.
No, if we just left them alone, they probably would have been fine on their own. But now we're introducing pesticides and removing their habitats, and they're really under a tremendous amount of pressure.
Oh, I can imagine. You know, I have a group called Disclosure Network New York, and we follow trends as far as structures of politics and what's happening in the universe. We go into paranormal phenomenon. We go into a lot of different areas. I've had that group for 21 years, and it's a fascinating group. And we come upon amazing information along the way. And, you know, one of the things we've been discussing the past few years has been the chemtrails in the skies, which are not water vapors coming from jets. They are spraying chemicals from planes worldwide into our skies. And it's a very, very important subject. And in the list of things that it does, interfere with, are the spraying that comes into the air and rains down on us, are the plants, the animals, and the bees. And there's a lot of people very concerned about the chemtrails and how the bees are being killed in large quantities. Are you familiar with that area at all?
No, I'm not. I see more of the pesticides and the things like that. I've never. I can see how it could certainly happen, because it happens to everyone, I guess. But,
oh yeah, it's true. It's worldwide. Monsanto. We're talking about spraying chemicals. Well, Monsanto is certainly one of those companies that has been under a justified fire for the harmful chemicals that are in their products. And are you aware that any of the bees have been hurt, killed by those kinds of products, or those spraying things they put on the grass?
Well, I think any sort of pesticide probably isn't good for people or the environment or nature in general. I mean, right on it, it says, you know, that you shouldn't be ingesting it. And spraying it around. So, I mean, I don't want to get too deep down the rabbit hole of pesticides and things like that. But
yeah, no, I agree. But it's of a big concern to a great many of us, even the city slickers here in Manhattan. We see that in Central Park, and there's been a lot of letters written about that. I want to ask you one question that I'm dying to ask you, is that I have been fascinated ever since I was a child by the beehives made up of a multiplicity of same size hexagon shapes that appear to be a perfectly aligned massive structures like that. Does anybody have a clue? I mean, it's such an architectural triumph, and I'm always in awe of the hexagon shapes that are part of the bee hives, that we call homes, whatever you want to call it. Do you have any information on how in the world they came to do hexagon shapes?
Millions and millions and millions of years of the honeybee being here with us, us with them, they have evolved to the point where they know they have to use every single square inch that they.
Right.
They have figured out that the hexagon is the most economical and the most the very best use of space to maximize their surroundings. So they have just figured out that the queen lays eggs in each one of them. So they have to use the space very wisely.
Tell us about the queen bee.
Sure. That's one of the things that we have done here at the apiary I was talking about earlier. It's Wetlands Apiary in Massachusetts. And we have a number of beehives. We have approximately 80, and we call them colonies. Some are much bigger than the others. But the colony, we have 80 colonies of bees. And
wow.
Each year, when the spring comes, we determine how many of those have made it through the winter. 10% is not uncommon. 10% loss is not uncommon. And it can range from 10% all the way to 40, 50% loss. So the 50% loss is a big hit. And
huge.
We have to replenish all those bees. But as I was saying earlier, one of the hardest things to do is get a colony to live through the winter. If they live through the winter, that colony usually will perpetuate itself for however long you want it to be in beekeeping. And we take the eggs from that queen. It's called grafting. And we artificially have the beehive, the colony, make us queen cells from our existing colonies. And once a year, we introduce a new breeder queen, so we're not muddying up the genetics, so to speak. And we continue to produce queen cells. With those queen cells, we put them into the new colonies, and we know that her stock has already made it through the previous winter. So she probably will stand a very good chance of all of her offspring making it through the winter also. So we are trying to support the buy your local bees. If you're going to get into beekeeping, try to get the bees from a local source rather than getting these, what we call southern bees, because they don't really work as well as our northern bred queens.
That makes total sense. I can understand that very well. Yes. Wow, it's such an incredible subject. I want to ask you also, just for a moment, back to the hives, back to the incredible construction. The question I have is, it's made of, I believe, wax. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. They produce their own wax. They have wax glands, which are on the rear of their abdomen, and from the time a bee is an egg and it matures and emerges out of the cell as a bee, it has a job from day one. And as it progresses through its life, different glands will come and go. As those glands come and go, their job changes. So in the very beginning, as their glands are starting to develop, they are janitors. They go around and they clean up the insides of the cells, remove any debris that has collected. Then the next job they do, which is after about 7 days, is they become nurse bees. their glands start to become more mature, and they are working their way to becoming a nurse bee. And as a nurse bee, they take care of the up-and-coming eggs and larvae as they're being produced. Once their nurse bee job has come and gone, getting back to what you were asking me about, the bees start to produce wax through their wax glands. And that's what they
now,
do inside of their...
That's how they do it. That is absolutely incredible. I mean, I find that incredible. And the fact that these structures are, they look like buildings, like miniature buildings, and very futuristic, I have to say, very futuristic. And I've seen architects take the hexagon and multiply that and make apartment buildings basically out of the hexagons. I'm thinking, I bet you I know where they got that inspiration. It's from our friends, the Little Bees. And they're amazing structures. I've seen a few of them on the internet. Have you ever seen a building like that?
Sure. Apartment buildings all over the place.
Have that hexagon basic structure.
Yep, it maximizes the space.
Yeah. But the fact that the little bees figured that out, I mean, that is just truly a miracle to me, a miracle that they were able, these little guys, to do something like that and make it so successful.
They work very well together. And another fact that you may not know, that probably 5% of the population of a beehive are male. 95%
Oh, really?
95% of it is female.
I never knew that. Never knew that. Wow. What other things that probably we don't know about bees and beehives and honey? Are there other things that you could give us?
Could go
share
on
with
for
us?
A long time doing this.
Well, please go ahead. We have a little bit of time. I would love to ask you that question. Yeah.
The queen. So there's one queen per hive, and she, her job is to lay eggs. From the time she emerges out of her queen cell, she is in the hive for about 3 days and goes out on a mating flight. And while she's out on the mating flight, she might mate with up to 15 or 18 male bees, which are called drones, and then she returns to the beehive, never to leave again.
Wow.
And while she's in the hive, in her prime, which is year 1.5 to probably year 2.5, she lays eggs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 6 months, probably from March to October. And in the middle of the summer, when it's nice and warm out, she could be laying up to 2,200 eggs every day.
I am knocked out with those figures. I think our listeners would also be knocked out also. That is absolutely incredible.
They're just wonderful creatures to learn about. It's just endless learning. But the queen is a very important factor in the whole hive, because the entire offspring, her offspring, tend to her when they're born. A bee's life is only about 50 days long. So the entire population of that beehive is her offspring. That's why we try to perpetuate bees that survive a winter, because the genetics are there, stands them a better chance going forward to make it through our climate.
Now, you said that they have to be kept at a warm temperature during the winter to survive. What is a favorable temperature? What range would there be that you have to provide for them?
Regardless of what it is outside, in the middle of the summer, when it's very warm up here, they have to stand at the front entrance and flap their wings very, very, very hard, and they get a wind that will go through the hive to vent it. But come wintertime,
wow,
like we're having right now,
right,
they go into what's called a cluster. And the cluster is probably about as big as, well, I don't know, maybe a small basketball. And they have the queen in the very center in a hole about the size of a golf ball. And they vibrate their wings very, very, very quickly. And it produces heat. And inside the beehive, even on a night like tonight when it's 15 or 20 degrees out, the beehive inside might be 75 or 80 degrees.
Really? It goes that high? I am knocked out again. That's absolutely incredible. I never heard of anything like that. Wow.
And inside this cluster, which is a large ball, the queen is sitting and they're keeping her warm. And they go, the AB will be up close to her and start to run out of energy, make its way back out to the outside of the ball, find some food, and bring some food not only for itself, but for the queen into the center of the ball and feed her so she can survive the winter.
Now, does the queen live as long a time as all the workers, or what is that ratio?
A queen bee will live 3 to 3.5 years, and she needs to be replaced. And when the colony, if the colony decides to replace the queen, the queen has a pheromone on her tail, and the pheromone is moves through the hive not only by smell but by taste. In her mouth she has another gland, and they call it the queen substance. And when the queen substance starts to weaken, is telling the colony that she's starting to fail, and they will replace her.
I got to ask you, Roger, when that happens, and the queen, when you say replace her, what happens then? Is she taken out of the hive? Does she die alone? When she dies, what happens to her body?
It's kind of survival of the fittest. When they decide to replace her, the bees will pick 7 or 8 perfect larvae to turn into a queen cell. And that process is another whole episode in itself. So it's a long involved process of what it takes to make a queen into a viable queen, let's say. So when they decide to replace her, they'll make 7 or 8 queen cells, and the first queen cell that the queen emerges from will go up to the other 7 and sting them all and kill them.
Really?
Then she will seek out the existing queen and kill her.
Wow.
And she is a very young, vibrant insect as opposed to the older queen who will be three and a half years old by then.
Now, when an old queen bee dies, is there a ceremony of some sort?
Nope, they just drop her to the bottom of the cage and drag her out.
Oh, wow. Wow. I just had no idea. So she's gone. She's year's news. And here comes the new queen, and let's welcome her in, and let's get going. Wow.
Yep.
That's incredible.
Do they make
sounds? Do bees? I know there's a humming you associate with a bee. Do they make other sounds? I don't know, to communicate, to indicate something with each other?
No, they do it in a different way. So it's a S-shaped dance they do, and in the bee world, they call it the waggle dance. And the foragers, which are the very last job a honeybee does, will go out foraging, and they will find a cherry tree that's loaded with cherry blossoms. Well, the stout bee, which is the forager, will come back to the hive, get onto the, it's called a frame. The inside of a beehive has, they look like picture frames. And that's what they build their wax onto. It will get onto the frame and do an S-shaped dance in a certain direction and turn around, go right back to where it started and do that same dance again. And that's telling all the other bees around it which direction, in accordance to the sun, is the direction it is on the frame, and the length of the dance it does tells the other bees how far away it is.
Wow.
It's absolutely fascinating. So they completely communicate by just their actions.
And they understand each other.
Yep. If you're any way familiar with YouTube, the waggle dance, it's very, very interesting.
The waggle dance.
I know.
I haven't heard of that. That's new to me. Wow.
Yeah.
That is absolutely, it's amazing. I keep saying that, but it's true. There's so much to learn about this incredible subject.
I'm very fortunate to surround myself with people that are far more knowledgeable than I am. I've been doing this for
You said that there's organizations for beekeepers, right? There are organizations, I guess they'd be worldwide, where you can ask your questions and they would give you responses and give you answers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's some very, very, very smart people out there.
So interesting.
One of the big ones is Cornell University.
Oh, really?
Yep. Cornell is... their entomology department focuses primarily a lot on bees.
Very interesting, too. Now, let me ask you a question. I know that some of our listeners would want me to ask you this, and that is sometimes when we're out on a beautiful sunny day in the spring or summer and a bee decides to sting us. Now, the question is, one, why would they do that, and what's the purpose of that? And the second one is, what can we do if we get a bee sting to help us survive that?
You would hope that if you were allergic to bees, that you would probably already know that. My son happens to be, which makes it difficult to do beekeeping here at home, so I have to go off-site to.
So your son is allergic to bee stings? Is that what you're saying? How ironic.
Yeah.
Isn't that ironic that he is and yet you are a beekeeper? That's so he can't really participate.
Actually, if you got into the science of it, he used to keep bees on me and get stung all the time. And then he took a long hiatus from beekeeping. And the next time he got stung, he was allergic.
Isn't that interesting that that happens that way?
Well,
do you think the bees in any way sense that a person is allergic to their sting? Or
no,
is there any way that they
No,
would,
I don't.
No? Okay.
No, I don't think so.
And why would they sting you in the first place? Is it? Go ahead.
What's that?
I was going
to
say, why do they do it? Right.
Getting back to your original question, if you get stung, I would wager that it wouldn't be by a honeybee. Honeybees are very, they will try to avoid you like you try to avoid them.
Okay.
Now a wasp or a hornet or a yellow jacket, you come close to their hive or they have a nest, they will attack.
Right. They're protecting their home. That's what they're doing.
That's correct.
As best they can, the little guys are protecting. Oh, wow.
Yeah,
are they attracted to any particular colors? By the way, someone told me that some of these stinging insects are attracted to certain colors, for instance, red. Is that true? Do you know?
No, I don't think red, but honeybees get defensive when they see very dark colors. And it's presumed that over the evolutionary period of the bees being around, bear population goes and attacks the beehives for the honey. So they naturally don't like dark-colored animals. They consider you an animal. That's why all beekeepers' bee suits are white.
That makes sense. I know that that's true, but I never knew why.
Yeah, most of them anyway. I mean, a little off color is one thing, but you're not going to get a dark blue one, let's say.
Do you get stung as a bee professional
all the time?
And do you put something on it?
No. No, I
just let it heal by itself.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I've gotten stung so many times that I get probably 10 or 15 stings a week.
Do you really?
Yeah,
oh, that's incredible. That is amazing to me. That really is. Wouldn't you think that they would kind of know that you're not their enemy? You're their friend.
You're going into their house.
You're going into their house, and so they're taking that as, okay, you know, if you're going to come into our house, you're going to pay the price.
Yeah, well, some of them are we also, I was explaining to you how we reproduce queens artificially at our apiary, and that's one of the things we breed for. We breed for them to be gentle and very passive. It's very difficult to have a hive that's aggressive. We actually will go into an aggressive hive, find the queen, and we'll kill her and replace her with a hive that's, or we'll replace her with a queen that's much more docile genetics.
Right. Well, what I'd like to do now, because the time is getting short here, is to say to our listeners, and by the way, listeners, thank you so much for selecting our program to listen to. We really appreciate that. And please do tell your friends. And if you have a question about the subject matter for either me or my guest, Roger Hill, you could direct it to my email address. And if it's for Roger, I'll give it to him through email. Or if it's for me, I'll try to answer it from here. So if you get a pen and a piece of paper, I'm going to give you my email address to do that. And again, we welcome your comments as well as your questions, for sure. So, okay, here, I'm going to give it to you twice. My email address is nicknyny1. And that's not O-N-E, it's the numeral 1, at gmail.com. I'm going to repeat it, nicknyny1, at gmail.com. And we'd be very, very happy to hear from you, for sure. Roger, I should ask my producer, Hercules, how much more time do we have for the program?
Around 8.5 minutes.
About 8.5. Well,
yes, sir.
Roger, I would just like to ask you, first of all, you've already given us so much information on this amazing subject. I just thank you so much for that. What would you like to leave tonight from you for the listeners of the program? About bees, or anything you would like to add or suggest, anything you want to talk about to the listeners, what would you like to say?
I'd just like to say I appreciate you giving me the time tonight, Nick. That was very gracious of you. But also be kind to the bees. They're under a tremendous amount of pressure, and without bees would be in a lot of trouble. So it's very important to keep up on the local bee habits of the beekeepers, try to support them, buy their honey, buy their wax products, get involved with the beekeeping community. It's a wonderful hobby, and you can meet some wonderful people. But in the big picture, we need to change the course that we're on. The bees are in terrible jeopardy, and they really are just a wonderful little insect. So take care of them, and they'll take care of you. And again, thank you very much for your time, Nick.
Well said, Roger. Well said, and what a wonderful program you've given us tonight. You've answered so many questions and shed light on areas that I think very few of us knew anything about at all. You've made a very good case for why it's so important that we treat the bees with respect. They deserve that. And for our own survival as well, very, very important. And we need to be very aware of the situations that are going on with the bee community and take action if we see that there's something that's wrong or should not be happening. And you can sign me up, Roger, on that level, because I promise you that myself, as well as my friends and neighbors, will absolutely heed your advice. I think it's excellent advice, and everyone should know more about that. I know that I wanted to tell you just briefly that in back of the big library here in Manhattan on 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue, where the big library is with the two lions in front, in back there's a park, a beautiful little park there, and there actually is a beehive. And actually, I saw that they were at one point selling honey from the Manhattan beehive. I spotted it once.
Be surprised at how many beehives that you have in your city.
I bet you're right on that. Yeah,
Boston being a small city, they put them on the
roof
of the house. They put them on the roof of the house and paint them to look like a chimney, and nobody knows they're there.
Wow. Again, you just blew me away again, Roger. You're amazing. Thank you so much. Again, you shed so much light. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Certainly very appreciated. So I'm going to go into our wrap now and say that this is Nick Curto for the Creative Process, wishing you all an enlightened and exciting journey as you find your own path to deepen your own creativity and energies, to more fully developing your talents, whatever they are, in however many areas of expression your life takes you. Until next time, embrace creativity on all its various forms. Stay safe and be very, very kind to one another, especially right now. Goodbye for now. Much love to you all out there. Again, Roger, many, many thanks. Good night.
Good night, and thanks to both of you. That was an incredible show. I learned more about bees than I ever knew. So thank you very much, and thanks to everybody who tuned in. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and you're waiting patiently in our queue, or whether you'll be checking out the program later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys, amazing adventures, and a healthy and happy new year. We're going to close with Michael Duncan's God Bless the World in the time we have remaining. Thanks again, guys.
Appreciate. Much love to you all.
God bless the world. 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 God bless. God bless the world. God bless the world. God bless the world. God bless the world.
Dear Lord, shine your face upon us and bless us, every one of us.
God bless the world. God bless the world. God bless the world. God bless the world. Sing it.